This broadcast is brought to you by the Legatum Institute, an international think tank and educational charity. We hope you enjoy this event.
Social capital doesn't follow wealth. There are poor parts of this country with a very settled population with huge bonds of social capital that protects people. Even though their income is low, they can still have rich and relatively good lives. And there are other parts of the country, and I think they're ones we really need to focus on, where social capital is so thin now, people's support is so little, that being financially and economically poor is catastrophic. But so too is having no neighbours, nobody visiting you, nobody to talk to, nobody to tell you where a new job is about to appear.
But if there are social bonds there that provide that and look after a community, is that indicative of a government that's failed in its role to do that? Or should we be pleased that those networks exist? In fact, the same question I asked to Louise, is it government's job to solve this? And if it isn't, who else?
Well, you know, I think it's all of our jobs to solve this. And I think there's a danger sometimes that we offload on the government the things that we should also be doing. And the government should be a partner in this process. Ultimately, the kind of social capital that Julia talked about is generated by individual people who are making choices and doing things for their neighbours and so forth. And no amount of legislation will get you there. I would like to pick up a couple of things that Louisa said that I thought were very, very important, which is this concept of making work pay. And what we're seeing, and we're seeing this around the world, we saw this a little bit in the Brexit vote, but we're also seeing it in the US with the US political, the US election. We just had the Trump-Clinton debate last night.
Very late last night.
And you see it in some parts of Europe, in Central Eastern Europe, in Poland and Hungary and other places, this rise of a sort of nationalism, populism, protectionism that is coming because there's a significant amount of people in this country and in other countries around the world who feel that the economy is rigged against them. You know, rightly or wrongly, and I think rightly, many people feel this. So they see that the numbers show that wealth has increased. The numbers show GDP has increased. But they're not feeling it themselves. You know, they're not seeing this. And they're also seeing other people doing extremely well. And this is creating an environment where they're rejecting any kind of establishment. That's what, you know, they're rejecting politicians, they're rejecting the conventional establishment, they're rejecting everything. And there's an inherent danger in that. And we've been in this kind of situation many times in the past, and it doesn't lead to a very healthy result. So one of the things that we have to do is we have to, first of all, acknowledge this. We have to acknowledge that there are people who feel that the economy is rigged against them. And I think generally politicians haven't done a good job of acknowledging that and sort of taking ownership of it. And then saying, well, why is that the case? Why are real wages falling at these record levels that you talked about? And part of it is the wage side of the picture. And the other part of it is something that Julia mentioned, which is the cost side. The cost side has gone up enormously. And so if you're looking at whether it's housing costs in London, whether it's energy costs across the whole country, the costs side is rising massively. And this is where the crony capitalism piece comes in, because what's happening is you're seeing a failure, not only in the UK, but I think in a lot of places, a failure of competition to actually do what it's supposed to do, which is to get companies to compete with each other so price comes down. So the cost that you pay for your clothes, for your energy, for your food, all of these things goes down. And as a result of the costs going down, you know, you're able to have more disposable income, and your wages, you know, will actually, your effective wage levels actually rise. So I think that is something that we very much need to focus on. Is look at the cost piece of this. I mean, look at the banking sector, for example. You look at the lack of competition in the UK banking system. Well, if you don't have a competitive banking system where people are able to get lots of, you know, loans and so forth easily, then you can't have any entrepreneurialism. You can't have any economic activity that creates a ladder out of poverty for people. So one of the things we're going to be doing at the Institute in the coming couple of years is looking at these industries that are really critical to ensuring that you've got a competitive situation, so your costs are going down and people can actually have more disposable income in their pockets. And those are things like banking, they're things like energy, they're things like telecommunications and digital, all of those sort of lifeblood industries that if you get it wrong, if you have a failure of competition in those industries, you're going to have escalating costs, which is, I think, what we see in this country.
Seema, thank you very much indeed. You've done a record, is it 20 of these?
I've done quite a lot, but this is going to be my favourite.
Excellent. Ever the politician, genius.
The one I'm most looking forward to.
Excellent. We have just been doing, we tried to define our terms, what we're talking about, and Julia has painted a picture of a changing face of poverty. The poor we were talking about 20, 30, 40 years ago is not the same now. Shankar has been trying to describe, as Legatum Institute tries to do all the time, what prosperity might look like, and it's not just about money. And Louise is trying to explain to us where she thinks Labour can get involved in this and whose job actually is it. And that's where we really came in, is whose job is it to change this? And it might not always be government. Maybe we all need to step up to the plate anyway. I know you've been thinking very carefully about this. Just explain what you feel needs to be done, should be done, can be done.
Great. Well, there's a lot of people. I might stand, actually, because I can sort of see people at the back as well. And I want to thank Legatum and for being part of a really interesting journey for me this year, thinking about how do we grow and share prosperity, and to be hosting this event at conference as well, and with a fantastic panel. I do think this is absolutely the fundamental question that we have, and it's in the context of sort of growing inequality here and around the world. I think it's time for some very different thinking, some time for some different thinking in the sense of how we've thought about prosperity has been quite individual. It's been quite individualistic in terms of how we even think about your income, and then how you pay taxes, and then even how you save, and then how you invest, all being a very sort of individual way of thinking about how we live our lives. But I think that there's real space for the collective to come in much more into this and think about not just prosperity, but all what's on the pathways to prosperity, being also a space for greater collective action. I was really inspired, I have to say, by your prosperity index and the framework behind that. The model, a model of thinking about prosperity that goes beyond economic prosperity to thinking about health, education, some aspects of the nation like security, but all those drivers of prosperity that can have a huge impact. And it has got me thinking very differently about how we think about this question. When I went through that and was thinking about how does that apply to the UK, when you've got all of those different dimensions, it distilled it down for me to three very, very important building blocks where I think there's space for us to move in as the Labour Party much more, but also space for us to think much more in a much more joined up way about how we develop our economic policy too, in order that our economic strategy is actually A, credible, and B, successful. The three building blocks I think are absolutely fundamental, and which is now shaping my thinking in the constituency, is if we're to achieve better economic outcomes and prosperity for individuals, then our education system and what we see as education behind that is absolutely the space to be investing and investing much more strongly. It's one reason why I see the 8% per pupil spending cut that the government is bringing in up to 2020 as being absolutely a step in the wrong direction in terms of thinking about prosperity and thinking about economic success in our nation. I'll talk a little bit about what that is meaning for schools in my constituency and why I just find it devastating and depressing every time I think about it. But in order to underpin that, in order to make sure that we've got an education system that is successful, the other dimension that the Legatum framework has really brought into play for me is social capital, and thinking really differently about social capital as a driver of prosperity. I found out fairly recently as well that my constituency in Hounslow features one of the lowest levels in indicators of social connectivity. And what that means is it's really hard for other initiatives to land and to be anchored in our community. It's really difficult for grant-giving bodies to give grants into the area as well. And a number of emails I get saying, we haven't had any applications, you're underrepresented. And I'm thinking, well, it's kind of really difficult for me as the MP to be writing bids. But how do we get this to happen? And what I have found is, well, you know, it's a kind of obvious point. If there isn't a bank account to pay a check into, then, and you don't have organisations set up or charities or associations that can help bid for developing initiatives in the community, A, you're not going to put in the bid, and B, it's not going to be credible. So where you see that you've already got social mobilities or social capital, you've got charities set up, you've got strong community infrastructure, those resourced areas in terms of our human capital are getting the resources to develop their economic success as well. So if we're to think about how we grow and share prosperity, I think we have to have a fundamental rethink, A, about how we see education as the vital route into that, and B, about how we support our school systems in our communities. The positive outcome of this is that I've broken a few rules of my own. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, we did put in a bid where I thought, hang on a minute, here is a great opportunity. There's a Skills and Opportunities Fund. Who can apply for it? Can't find anyone. So we went into partnership with a school and we've developed a bid to help support an initiative that we're launching called Hounslow's Promise, absolutely based around this thinking and inspired by America's Promise. Now, what America's Promise has done over the last 10 years is it's set up to absolutely focus on the children that don't graduate from high school. And they have a vision and a mission of making sure that every young person graduates from high school. I took that and thought, and I looked at our GCSE results with a different lens, and I was absolutely shocked, and this is why I say this everywhere I go, over a third of our children in this country get to age 16 and do not achieve the equivalent of five good GCSEs. That's over a third. And in my constituency, well, I say the borough of Hounslow, so one London borough, that's 900 kids in 1 year. 900 kids not getting the equivalent of five good GCSEs. And when I then look at what the Tories are doing, and I'm not getting over partisan, but when I look at what the Tories are doing, and I look at how they're cutting per pupil funding in our schools, to me that is absolutely against any sensible and evidence-based economic strategy, and it is absolutely working against the interests of those children, the interests of their families in the future, and the interests of our community. But what I recognise as well from this thinking and how we develop pathways is that it isn't the schools alone that are going to be able to do it. And the schools, we all know, and Louise has been really kind of effective in Parliament at raising some of these issues as well, that when you see how schools are struggling, I'll give you just a couple of stories. They won't be able to create much more of the investment and the capacity building to have their kids be able to take opportunities up and have pathways out of poverty for themselves in the future. I had one school tell me in July that they were giving money to parents for small things, and they were talking about kind of shoes and new school uniforms. I said, what kind of frequency are you looking at? And I was absolutely shocked to hear them say that it's probably about an average of twice a day. Twice a day, they're giving money to parents to buy schools, school uniforms or shoes. I had another school tell me that they replaced one child's shoes because they were in such bad condition, and his uniform because he was being teased by other pupils. And then I've been doing a little research on debt from a parental debt, so i.e. how much parents are owing schools for school trips and other things. One school told me that they thought that had probably reached about £30,000. That's one school, one primary school. And so there is a huge level of what we're doing, which is driving people into poverty, not just for today, but for tomorrow, by the choices we're making right now and the lack of visibility of the impact of them. But the good news is, because I always end on a positive note, that we're looking to do something about that in our locality. And I'm delighted that we've got a councillor here, Councillor Hanif Khan from Hounslow, who and Shibra as well, who's here, because inspired by America's Promise, we're developing Hounslow's Promise, which is making a customised set of pledges to young people and to the and into the community, which is looking at how we develop a network of caring adults around young people, so that there can be a sense of you know, mentoring and aspiration and messages that are given. How that can be, how a community coming together, volunteering and bringing all of our assets as individuals and life experience can support parents as well. How we can make parents part of that story of their children's development. How we can support teachers who are working with individual schools about what they think will make a difference for them. And how we develop youth leadership. So on the back of that, and in to inform that and drive that, we've launched a youth advisory board, and we're having a youth conference, and already some of the conversations we're having with young people, it's incredibly simple what they're asking for. And incredibly simple what they're asking for from a community that's on the edge of London, but that quite frankly does not share in London's prosperity. So they want some of the basics. They want people to come in and talk about what their jobs are like. They want people to come in and explain how they can get on, because our career service is absolutely not fit for purpose. We know that. And they're getting all the kind of, you know, the very poor advice, very poor sense of direction. And in the, you know, in the meantime, they see Heathrow right next door, or they see, you know, kind of, you know, the trains that take them into London. Not many of them will necessarily go. So in my view, somehow how we take our resources from where we can access them, when we take the community resources into the community, into what they're asking for, make a huge difference. So on the back of that, we're working with the Hounslow Chamber of Commerce, who've committed to be part of this, the local authority that will give us everything but money, because their budgets are being cut by 130 million over the course of 10 years. But they are absolutely behind it as an initiative. And what I want to see is, as we bring our resources together with businesses involved in schools in a far more easier way for schools to engage with a way in which we change our thinking about work experience, with a way in which we engage our public lecture series with, I've signed up 3 journalists to come into our schools and our community to give a talk actually as well, the way in which we connect people and connect people with concepts of where they can go in their own lives and the route map that maybe can help them do that, I think we can join up these questions. We can't do it alone. I think it needs a massive strategy for community cohesion, and quite frankly, the government pulling out some of a lot of that community infrastructure and community cohesion resources through the withdrawal of support for local authorities as having a negative effect. So we're fighting fire on this one. But if Labour can come in with a much more coherent strategy for education, how that informs our economic strategy, how that informs a comprehensive industrial strategy so we get a better matching of supply of skills to the workforce and the demands of the future, and how we can have a much more integrated social cohesion and social capital strategy that is much more uniting than the division that has come from the last few years particularly and the impact of the Brexit vote, then I think we're on a different pathway and probably a much more successful one. Thank you.
Super, thanks very much indeed. I'm absolutely delighted you mentioned the Prosperity Index, because that's our key publication. And I will give you, as you've been good enough to sit and listen, a small heads up, which I think speaks a great deal to what you've just been saying. Our UK Prosperity Index is published on October the 13th, but one of the key findings will be the fact that local areas are very good at generating their economic policy, their local area funding, their economic plan is going very, very well. But in the very same place, people are really not prosperous. So something's going wrong in that chain. That social bit is not working well. But here, where you probably won't thank me, I wonder whether sometimes, you're a London MP, you've just been talking very eloquently about that, whether we're based in London, there's sometimes, I know you're in York, so that's slightly unfair. Is there a perspective that we miss sometimes, that actually this looks slightly different in a place like Sheffield, that we actually, we've got plans, we're looking at all of this stuff, but actually you're getting a different sort of poverty possibly?
I think that's a problem across across Whitehall, across government, across a lot of political thinking in this country, and this government are increasingly centralising themselves in London, which means they don't have that regional perspective and perspective from across the UK that is absolutely needed. In Sheffield, we have fantastic, what did you call it, social connectivity? Is that what Hanzo had?
So we're still defining terms. I mean, that's the point. Actually, looking at this, we're still finding the terms. Yeah, the social connectivity, I think you mentioned. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have amazing community groups that have grown up or particularly expanded over the last 6 years in order to fill the spaces that the state has left behind through the enormous local government cuts. Sheffield City Council has had its budget halved since 2010. So these groups have had to emerge. And actually, in some instances, they are doing a better job than local government was able to do before because they are rooted in their community and they are genuinely, immediately accountable to their community. We've not closed a single library in Sheffield, but several libraries are now voluntarily run and they're actually doing a better job than some of the local government libraries.
And perhaps we shouldn't be afraid of embracing that.
I think that's right. I think we have a statist instinct in the Labour Party and often that's right. I think government is the greatest agent for change in the country and in the economy. But I think we also have to be open to new models of partnership and not just the classic sort of landlord-tenant or procurer and commissionee of services that we've done too much of in central and local government.
Julie, you wanted to come in on.
I think geography really matters, and I think both our MP colleagues have shown that.
Yeah.
It's very, very different in very different parts of the country. And poverty, it's too simple to say there's London and the South East and the rest. There are areas in the north of England that are booming like a train. There are other areas with very strong social capital of the sort you've described. What we need to do is become much more geographically literate and understand that much better. And I'm fully with you. I think there are different movements taking place which we need to be close to. Because actually, how people get out of poverty is complex, and the ways in which they then live is complex. Your figures from Hounslow are really striking, because so often London is described through the London Challenge, education has been transformed, clearly not, in some places. And I think we have to address that fine detail of what's different in different areas.
Another snippet, you mentioned geography, some places are actually booming. Another snippet from our Prosperity Index struck me when I saw it. The North East is one of the best places to set up a new business in the country. I wasn't expecting that. And it's
at the moment, they get a lot of funding from the European Union.
Well, that's it. Yes, that. Well, well, why don't we do that for just a little moment? Will Brexit make this task harder or easier?
Well, I don't think we...
You're secretly thinking, thanks for that one, Giles.
Yeah, yes, thank you, Giles. No, I think we need to figure out what it all means first, because it could be almost anything at this point. And there are certain things... I think one thing that is clear, the notion that this vote means that we are going to be less interested in Europe, even from the most diehard, you know, Brexiteer, is not accurate. In fact, we're going to be much more interested in Europe over the next few years because we're going to be talking about our relationship with it in much more detail than we ever have. So this notion that the Britain is sort of turning its back on Europe is fiction. I mean, we're going to be extremely engaged with Europe, and we're going to have relationships, regardless of what happens in the future on actual trade agreements. We're going to have relationships with European institutions, and we're going to have, you know, funding relationships in terms of our universities and European research grants and all the rest of it is going to have to continue. I wanted to pick up again something that Seema said in terms of your partnership with when you bid for this grant together with a local school. I think that's the kind of partnership that I was talking about at the beginning in terms of government and the private sector working together, or government and other non-government actors working together to deliver social change. I think we have sort of relied on government-only solutions for too long. And there's a whole range of things that can be done that build social capital and build the education system that we haven't really even tapped into. So I'm really pleased about that. And I think with one of the things we do at Legatum is we do a series of events with schools that are from underprivileged areas and so forth, and teach, frankly, many of the things that students are not necessarily going to get access to otherwise. We have an open, a pop-up university kind of thing, really, for high school students to get them ready for university. And, you know, we'd love to partner with you, actually, frankly, on some of those. So I think these are all elements of building social capital. I mean, for those who don't know about the Prosperity Index at the Institute that Sima mentioned, the index measures prosperity across 9 different pillars. So we look at, obviously, economics, but we also look at education, we look at healthcare, we look at security, we look at
governance,
we look at all kinds of things. Healthcare,
social capital,
I mean, there's environment, you know, there's a range of things that go into the, you know, whether the individual human being in a particular region, in a particular country, anywhere in the world, is actually prospering or not. And what we found is that many of these things, there's a lot of positive feedback loops amongst these things. Mm. So if you start to get some things right, you tend to get a virtuous circle sort of developing, and you tend to people rise out of poverty. And the other, the flip side of that is when you get things wrong, there's a vicious circle that goes down. And what we see, and this is obviously very troubling for policymakers, and it presents policymakers with a very, very big challenge, which is there isn't this happy middle ground where you can sort of half get it right and sort of be okay. You're either going to take off or you're going to collapse. And I think within the microcosm of Britain as a country, you know, you can sort of see in different regions both of those things happening in different areas.
Can I raise all four of you and have a think about how we do this? But I was very struck by what you're saying, Sima, is that there is already poverty in existence. We know that, you know that at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. There is poverty existing that we need to learn how to tackle, how we can assist. And you're talking about a poverty that's being built in for the future, and we're sitting talking about it. It's difficult to know how we tackle it. We're coming up with some ideas. Have we got time? Is this running away with us? Are we behind the curve, and quite badly behind the curve?
Good question.
It's a very good question. And I think we are behind the curve, but that's not a reason for giving up. I think we know what we need to do. But I do think it requires a very different approach about the relationship between the community, the state, and government.
Yeah.
I think community, government, and business. We need to understand how that works more. If government only has in its locker the tools of regulation, we'll end up in a very narrow place, because actually that's not how you do it. You do it by a different form of engagement. So in many of the cities in the UK, growth strategies are being developed by companies who absolutely know that if they're employing poorly paid staff, there is no prospect for economic growth and recovery there. It's not enough money. It's not money circulating around. It's how we have that conversation. But we are storing up trouble for ourselves. There's huge indebtedness households are facing. And the number of adults of working age who are no longer able to prepare for their old age. So I said in my presentation, we've broken the link between old age and poverty. We're about to see it again, unless we collectively intervene. And the cold spots that you talked about, where there is very little activity going on, are all over the UK, and they're not just in the poorest places, but there are places where people can't take action.
Louise, what does that look like? I mean, when someone comes to your surgery, and expect, how do you say to them, well, we're working on this, we're breaking the, you know, what can you say to someone who's part of their lack of social capital is they have no hope and they have no belief that anything's going to change?
Yeah, absolutely. And clearly, we know we didn't do anywhere near enough of this when we were in government. I will just agree with something Julia said earlier, in that nobody's ever been lifted out of poverty. We lifted millions of children out of poverty through child tax credits and child benefits. So that was the enabling agent of government that did that. But we didn't challenge the fundamental issues in our economy that have entrenched poverty and why inequality has risen over the last 30 years. And that's why what Sima said about a new economic and industrial strategy are so important, and the relationship of education to that, ensuring that we are protecting and growing the skills for the future that we need, because our education system seems so disconnected from our economic plans and economic strategy, and it was that we shied away from. And the economic model, as you touched on earlier as well, you know, I worked in the city before I was elected, and they're further ahead in this thinking than the Labour Party is. My chief executive used to go and speak at the UN about conscious capitalism and changing, you know, the shareholder model. But we weren't brave enough to do that in government, and I think that's something we should be quite ashamed of ourselves for.
And see, but do you think that, you know, we are dangerously behind the curve? We're clearly looking at model. We're clearly looking at what needs to be done. There seems a sense of people coming round to the idea that actually this might work better if we did this differently. But that's all still talk. I mean, how do you explain to someone in that situation, we're working on it?
Look, I think there's two. There's two perspectives on this. First, sometimes when you talk to people, they may not see themselves as poor either.
Mm. I wondered that.
Absolutely.
But what they don't know is what they don't have access to. And, you know, I'm absolutely going to invite you in on the sort of the university access project, not least because two wards in my constituency are pretty much in the bottom 20 wards in the country for sending kids to university. And when you look at some of the, you know, the relationships between, you know, how transport is working in those, in that part of the constituency, you know, train station, which buses reach, there's only one bus, where does it take you? You know, there's a sense of what you've designed in and how you've designed people to stay there. So for me, this question goes far beyond it being the responsibility for the DfE or being the responsibility for communities and local government. Or it's actually got to be far more integrated, because with the finite resources of the state, you've got to use it far more effectively. And the other dimension of this is the people dimension, because building pathways into prosperity is also a people story. So when you're talking or you're looking at where poverty is taking place, and what we've done, and tax credits enabling people to also be in work, stay in work, and look after their families. Sure Start, another area where we've seen the closure of 700 Sure Start centres. Those were the early intervention environments where literally mums would walk there with their kids in deprived areas, get have a place, because I think place is also really important, where they were building relationships, people relationships, many P's in this, with each other. Now, I know that the slimming down and the taking away, you know, it's glossed up with warm words about, you know, reviewing of our strategies, but what it's going to do in the medium and longer term for our places is going to have a negative impact, and for those kids coming through, they'll have less that's connecting them with each other. So I do think that there's something important about saying, well, look, we made a lot of progress on some of the social infrastructure, as well as having a really good third sector strategy under Labour. That social infrastructure is being taken out. And there is a mindset currently of people just being able to do it for themselves. You can't do it for yourselves without the basics of some resources in place. So we can, you know, do what we can, but we, you know, it would be far easier and far more effective if you actually had a strategy for that social infrastructure and it was connected by some thinking that went beyond the silo.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.